Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Think of a grizzly bear. She's very big, very powerful. Maybe her fur is rich and long, ready for winter. Maybe she has a cub following along, careful to stay close to his protector. Where is she standing? In the Alaskan tundra, digging roots? Or in a high mountain Montana meadow looking for ground squirrels? No, this mama grizzly is smack in the middle of a barren, scorching desert. And watching her is Montana writer Doug Chadwick. Doug, thanks for joining us again on Home Ground.
Good to be here and good to have you at my home.
Thank you. We're sitting here in Doug Chadwick's home near Whitefish, Montana, looking out at some beautiful mountains. Speaking of mountains, I understand you were recently in the Gobi Desert.
I was there for a month, between mid-April and mid-May.
Tell us where we're talking about.
Okay, let's go right to the heart of the largest continent, Asia. And we're right in the center of it, and where southern Mongolia meets the border of China. Very close to that, in southern Mongolia, though, the very southwest corner.
Mongolia is an Asian country that is independent, totally independent?
It is. It's newly independent since 1992. It was under Soviet domination before that. And, of course, about 700 years before that, it was the heart of the largest empire ever assembled on the planet. But that was in Genghis's time.
Now, how did you end up interested in the Gobi Desert? That's a long way from Whitefish, Montana.
Well, I was tracking snow leopards in the northwestern corner of Mongolia many years ago, and my translator was a young woman who kept talking about Gobi bears, because there are brown bears, you know, we'll call them brown/grizzly bears, okay? The same species.
As are grizzlies.
Ursus arctos. And in that northern part, you're not far from Lake Baikal in Russia. You're in a forested mountain place with lake. You could be hiking in Glacier Park. Hmm. And sure enough, there are bears there. But she said they're not quite like the Gobi bears. And I thought, oh boy, I may look like a tourist, but I'm not. There can't be grizzly bears in the Gobi Desert. And she said, yes, there are. My father is head of Great Gobi Special Protected Area, and he's made a special study of them. There are about 30 left in the world as far as we know.
Now, wait a minute. We're talking about this famous large desert, and in part of this desert, there are grizzly bears?
We're talking about the third largest desert in the world, parts of which look like photographs sent back by the Mars rover. Others look like the barrens people always imagine. When they picture a desert, there are dunes, there are salt flats. It's a place where you go and die. But if you think, this is also where the Great Silk Road ran, the world's center of commerce for a long time, between India, China, the western part of Eurasia. That's also through the Gobi.
All right, so you learn that there are bears there, and you said about 30 left?
Well, that's what I had heard. And, okay, as a biologist, you say no one looking at an area this size knows how many bears there are. That's a guess. It's not a sandy desert. It's a seemingly endless succession of gravel plains broken by ragged desert mountains that are eroded into canyon mazes and an impossibly complex terrain. And how do you go census bears there? That's what I ended up doing.
Why would you be interested in that process? I mean, you travel all over the world writing about science, conservation, nature, people working to save wildlife. Why would that pull you?
Well, wouldn't the Gobi Desert pull you? That's one of these corners of the earth. This is a place of mystery. It's a place I would be just like anyone else. I have stories in my head from things I've read. I picture bandits and Chinese emperors expanding their territory. I picture guys crawling on their knees looking for that fabled oasis. And there's a book and subsequently a movie called The Long Walk about some people who escaped from a Russian prison camp and went through the Gobi, and it was writhing with deadly poisonous snakes.
No, I don't think I'd like to go there. So.
Well, all I knew is this sounds interesting, and I'm a bear groupie. When I get a spare moment here at home, I'm up in Glacier Park living at a level I can't live at anywhere that doesn't have grizzly bears because all my senses are on full alert.
Okay, let's talk about why bears.
Why bears?
You've written about a lot of different animals. When you were on the show last, you talked about wolverines. You talked about experience with whales. We'll talk about your work in a minute, but why is it bears have a particular magnetism for you?
Bears have the virtue, as I said, of demanding that you pay attention and practice a little humility. But as an ecologist, bears use all kinds of habitats. And, of course, we'll get to the fact that if they can live in the Gobi, that requires a lot of traits that are worth examining. But they use vast territories. And so they become a umbrella for usually a whole community of other wildlife. If you're taking care of bears and you're learning about the place in which they live, you're going to have an intact and full, varied community of other creatures. And my first question was, now what would that be in the Gobi?
So you had to go over there to answer the question. First, how many times have you been over there? Now?
I've been over there 4 times.
All on the bear issue?
All to go try to give the last Gobi bears on Earth. They're the rarest bears in the world. And I wanted to look, it's simple curiosity. I want to know, who are these guys? How do they possibly live there? And who lives with them?
All right. I'm going to say that it's more than curiosity because you don't want the bears to disappear. Is that fair?
I surely don't. I'd worked with some other biologists I was chasing snow leopards again in northern India. And the snow leopard biologist I was with, we came across a grizzly bear. It's a Himalayan brown bear, okay? Mm-hmm. And it looks exactly like bears I've met around here, with silver tips and gold color. And what I wanted to get across was that this snow leopards, of course, are like finding Sasquatch. You cover huge amounts of mountain terrain and maybe see some sign. Mm-hmm. The snow leopard biologist I was with was way more excited to see grizzly prints and then eventually see the bear itself, and went running down the mountainside towards it. And I thought, well, they do things a little differently here in northern India. I'm not running towards a grizzly bear. But it reflects the fact that there are only 30 left in that whole vast arc of the Himalayas that run through India and Pakistan.
Really?
Yeah. And so this Gobi bear situation is not terribly unusual. You could find maybe 30 bears hanging out in the Carpathian Mountains. You could find a similar number maybe in Romania. These nuclei of bears, they are adapted to survive at low numbers. They're adaptable to all kinds of habitats, and they can hang on. They live up to 35, 40 years. And I thought, well, maybe these Gobi bears have a real shot at recovery, because I knew they had declined from former numbers as soon as I started to look into the history a bit.
You're listening to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn, and we are talking with writer Doug Chadwick about the Gobi Desert grizzly bears. We're going to come back to what the work is you've been doing in the Gobi. You've said you'd made four trips there. But let's take a step back. What led to your interest in nature? Where did that come from, the natural world?
From being out in it since I was young. And
young where?
Young in Spokane, Washington, and young traveling with my father each summer, who was a geologist, into the mountains and learning to look for stuff. He wanted to find copper. I wanted to find more cool bugs.
And how old are we talking about starting out on this
six,
path?
Six, seven, okay. Something like that.
So where did that lead you?
I've never been able to answer this question, Brian, because it sounds too pretentious to say it spoke to me, but I mean, I was just called. Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating. It's just always gripped me, and I always wanted to just know more, and then know at another, the secondary level, how does this work? I mean, you know, first it's the gee whiz, look at this thing, and look at what it's doing, and then how? And I was lucky to grow up in a house that had books on every shelf and shelves in every room. And so I could learn as I went. And the more I probed, the more I found. And that's the trick about nature, is there's no end to the discovery. And there's no end to the learning. And there's no end to the wonder.
There's a line in one of Jim Corbett's books, I think it's called Jungle Lore, and he was, of course, as you know, the 19th, 20th century naturalist and hunter of man-eating tigers, where he wrote something almost verbatim what you just said. In the book of nature, there's no beginning and no end.
It's absolutely true, and it's also, of course, for any young man trying to understand life and himself and all the things we were curious about, I am nature. And I came from nature. I still exist in nature, difficult as that is to see sometimes. And if I'm ever going to understand that, I'd better get on it. But it wasn't like an obligation. It was compulsion. I'm going to digress for just a minute. There are trillions of cells in our body. There, and I don't know how many trillion, but I do know there are 10 times that many microbes in the human body.
More than cells.
More than human cells. They're digesting, they're fighting off other microbes, they're doing all kinds of things for us. Inside each cell that we have, the minority in our body, inside the cell of every living thing is mitochondria. These are the energy packets, the organelles within each cell that make it possible to have motion, for things to happen. They power life. Hmm. They are highly modified bacteria. So all the way down from, you know, the top of our heads to the internal parts of our cell, we're combined with nature. And it always is interesting to me how people could possibly view nature as a take-it-or-leave-it sort of subject. I mean, I'm not that interested in nature. I said, well, you're wrapped up in nature and partnered with nature from the you know, the organic molecule level on up. How can you not be fascinated?
Well, let's talk about that. Not only not fascinated, but there's another aspect to it, one would argue, perhaps. I'd be interested in your views, that we have in modern times, perhaps as a result of technology, perhaps initially as a result of agriculture, tried to find ways to separate ourselves, our existence from the natural world. We're different.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that's been part of our history?
Sure. And it's, I couldn't explain to you, I'm not a psychologist, I can't explain to you the reasons it's so, why we work so hard to differentiate ourselves and, of course, put ourselves at the top of whatever pyramid we construct of importance, of, you know, intelligence, everything
right.
else. I've been lucky to work with elephants and killer whales, which have killer whales have a brain four times the size of ours. And working with people studying their communication and this smug human view of the world, I mean, that's fine. I like to feel good like everybody does and important, but I can't find anything to justify it. But even apart from that, it's just, aren't you intrigued by, there may be things that are smart, as smart or smarter than us, and I want to learn from them. And in the case of bears, they have the largest brain to body weight ratio of any carnivore. Let's say they're long lived, they're figuring stuff out. That's part of why they can exist where they do.
Now, you just said something, and I want to make sure I understood it. The largest brain ratio to body weight of any carnivore, that includes Homo sapiens, that includes us, because
we're not a carnivore technically.
We're an omnivore.
That's one of those technical, you got to have longer fingernails than you do and two big canine teeth to be a carnivore.
Let me just pursue something. We were talking about the common human desire, at least in modern times, to try to separate and distinguish ourselves from the natural world. And you were, of course, talking about how we are part of and nature is part of us. It's inseparable. But let me ask you another thing. What's your sense for the commonness of human interest in understanding? In other words, you are sort of an exceptionally passionate person in that. But if you take the average child, let's say in today's world, growing up with video games, modern technology, that's about as far removed as from the natural world as we have been as a species. What's your sense for the interest of that's in us about the natural world?
There have been studies of this, Ryan, and I may be just an example of some stunted personality where all of us start off with that curiosity and the gee whiz factor. And you cannot take a child outdoors and show them things at a certain age and not have them be right with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then by one means or another, that is effectively squelched later on. And a lot of the biologists I've worked with and the really great naturalists are, you could say, either brilliant, admirable human beings or stunted, they're perpetual 11-year-olds or maybe 8-year-olds. But it's also as you age, you now are accepting society's definitions of what it means to be human, which I think are way off because, again, it's isolating. It's putting a chasm between us and all the rest of life that surrounds us. And this business of being a big, important human and taking nature as something as more like a hobby or an interest or art or something, and losing a heck of a lot of it, which, of course, we'll probably talk about. But
You mean losing it in terms of?
We're in the age of great extinction, this great sixth extinction. And the joy for me is not in being separate and better and different, which I don't believe we necessarily are, but it's more being part of this community, being part of this huge process that involved millions of years of field testing different behaviors, different molecules, different patterns, different ways of living. Every creature that exists out there is a correct answer to the question of how best to live on this planet. We've got a heck of a lot to learn from everything from microbe level up to elephants and great whales. And we share, 97% of our genes with primates. We share 60% with, or it's some high number, with bananas. There's a commonality that isn't just my philosophy or wishful thinking. It's genetic. It's molecular. And it couldn't be more real.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Doug Chadwick. So let's go back to the bears in the Gobi. What are you doing over there?
Besides avoiding work. And I do love being out in a tent for a month holding the sides together in dust storms, and I'm just one of those people.
Strange is what someone might call it.
But. Yeah, and I'll cop to that. Look, as I said, a bear is an umbrella species. So as we work to learn about in order to save the last Gobi grizzlies, we are working with in an area that has the bulk of the world's last wild Bactrian or double-humped camels, which are wonderful.
Those are wild?
They're wild. Yeah, huh. There are domestic versions of them, but they live in the wild in big troops that are like these wild caravans moving through the desert landscapes. They're huge.
I hate to admit my ignorance in public, but you're telling me that those double-humped camels are a native wild
They're
animal?
They're native wild animal.
I didn't know that.
And there are, okay, we've got donkeys down at my neighbor's place and mules,
right.
But we've got wild asses in the Gobi thundering across the desert, leaving these rooster tails of dust.
Now, we're not talking vernacular when you say wild asses.
We're
these
not
are
talking
like
about chasing wild ass in any other sense but good, pure biological fact, okay?
Huh. That is a species, wild
these
asses.
These are a species.
And they're like a mule or donkey.
They are only fleeter and tougher,
okay.
Living in a desert adapted. They're the ones that etch the mountainsides with their trails and their sharp hooves that I follow through these mazes of the desert mountains. I'm on a wild ass path whenever I travel. I trust them to find the fastest, best way through it. When I go into the canyons and find a choke point, a kind of a narrow part in one of the canyons looking for maybe a lost oasis or a spring, I see the scrapings and droppings of snow leopards. I see wolf prints everywhere. I see the foot pads of Asiatic lynx, which are the size of our cougars. I see our galli, which are a great wild sheep up
the
on
great
the,
large-headed.
Very large,
large
yeah.
Animal, beautiful animal.
They really are. They're the great sweep of curling horns. And ibex, the wild goat with a 3 or 4 foot long horn looking down at me. The full community, we'd have to tell stories about camel spiders, camel ticks, and scorpions. But we'll keep on with the fuzzy guys.
So in that natural wonderland, how do you go about trying to save the bears you said you were? That's right. Why you were there.
It's two-pronged to save this mostly unknown and surprising rich community of wildlife. One is nuts and bolts of biology. We capture the bears, put satellite collars on them, collect fur for genetic analysis, set up automatic cameras.
How do you collect fur from a living grizzly bear?
You go where everybody there goes. You go to the water. You go to an oasis, and you string some barbed wire. Hmm. And that will snag some fur, and you can analyze that and get the minimum number of individuals in.
Through, like, DNA in the hair?
Yep, DNA in the follicles of the hair.
Okay, so I interrupted you. That's part of your strategy is that?
That. The camera traps identify individuals. The radio collars show us the extent of their range. We are giving them supplemental food. Feed the bears, the opposite of what we tell everybody in Montana.
And why are you giving them supplemental food?
Because their range has shrunk as livestock herders moved in to parts of the Gobi. And this is their last stronghold, and there are only, who knows, 8 to 12 breeding females, and we want them fat and producing babies. So we do collar and faller, as we say in biology. And the other part of this is perhaps more important is working with the Mongolian government, working with and training young Mongolian scientists and land managers, passing on what we've learned, but the techniques of how to learn it. Mm-hmm. And then the government has to not only support the rangers who work there, They need simple things like working vehicles and gasoline, but they have to keep out a flood of ninja miners, as we call them. These guys that slip in under cover of darkness and dig for gold.
What's the problem? It's a big area. Why would that be a problem?
Well, we all need water, don't we? And the ninja miners are there. Nobody else can use that water hole. It's that simple.
So they locate at the water hole the same water that the bears and the other animals use.
Nobody operates in the Gobi without water, mm-hmm. and we all collect around the water holes.
So that's the plan. What do you think the chances of success are?
Fair to middling. I could show you two photographs taken last year of mother bears with twin baby cubs. They're the first pictures ever taken of reproduction in Gobi bears. We knew it was happening. It's so wonderful to see it. You cannot turn your back on an animal that's holding its own and doing what it's supposed to do. You can't walk away.
Those bears and their cubs are half a world away, literally. Why do you care about them?
I'm going to use up our remaining time sitting here thinking.
All right.
And I think it goes back to when I first looked in a microscope at a puddle of water, or I first turned over that rock and saw that beetle. It's like, this is wonderful. And I sense that I'm part of this. It's part of me. And I can't imagine living in a world without this level of splendor, of wonder, of just curiosity. And as I said, let's have an assumption that I have something to learn from these animals. How do you live in a desert that's this bleak and this tough? And I'll bet these bears know a whole lot that I can learn from. They know it physiologically. They know it in their large brain. But I don't think you need a reason to save baby Gobi bear cubs. I'm struggling for one. I don't think you need one.
Doug Chadwick, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.